That was wonderful. The third talk today is by Ian McCrae, Versatile Strategy for Internal Labeling and Domain Localization in EM. Dolores. I hope you're going to tell us what Dolores stands for.
Yeah.
Doesn't it mean pain in Spanish?
Yeah, something like that. I should start by thanking the organizers and Ron. I didn't ever set out to make any technology to make anything better. I just have my own problems that I selfishly try to solve, and I guess sometimes good things come out of it. Right, so
my lab.
This is better, yeah. So I'm interested in studying gene silencing by double-stranded RNA from a mechanistic and structural standpoint. And so really I'm interested in looking at these enzymes and that catalyze these reactions. And so really the pathway I'm studying, which maybe doesn't matter so much for this talk, is how double-stranded RNA is recognized by cells and then used to elicit gene silencing. It's called RNA interference or variations on that. And so I'll talk today about the enzyme that catalyzes the very first step in this process. And that's this specialized ribonuclease named Dicer that recognizes double-stranded RNA. Usually it's just like a foreign RNA, like a virus or something. And then the important thing it does is it cuts it down into small RNAs of uniform size, about 21 nucleotides long. And then that then allows them to be used as guides for gene silencing of anything that's complementary to the anything complementary to the small RNA. So really trying to understand how this process happens so you can have downstream gene silencing. So when you start thinking about Dicer and what this enzyme really has to do, there's really basically three steps. You have the enzyme and you have its double-stranded RNA, and it needs to take this long double-stranded RNA of any length and chop it down into small fragments of a defined size. And so the very first step, of course, is binding. And it's very important that Dicer binds because it can't cut if it doesn't bind. But also, it's important that it recognizes the end. It binds to the end of the double-stranded RNA, and then that allows the second step, which is cleavage. And then by cutting a set distance from the end, that gives you the set size. That's fine. And then it uses energy from ATP to translocate down the RNA, flying down the RNA, and cutting every 21 base pairs as it goes. And then the job is done. These things go down and feed into the downstream silencing pathway. So I understand how this process works on a much more detailed level. So when we started in the current chapter of this project, we knew a lot about the protein. So basically we know it's a big protein, about 220 kilodaltons, a single polypeptide chain. We know it has all of these domains that had different names. In fact, at this point, we knew basic functions for most of the domains. For example, this domain here in the middle called PAS, it's responsible for recognizing the end of the RNA. And then the cleavage happens here by the RNase 3 domains over in the C-terminus. And then this stuff here is involved in translocation, these helicase-like domains. So we know what all these domains are. We know their functional roles. We even, at this stage, had crystal structures of these domains or homologous domains from other proteins or other organisms. So we know what all the parts and pieces look like. We know what most of them do. And the final question was, how do they all come together to make this functional dicing machine? So that was the challenge. And so we tried to get crystals, of course, and we haven't been able to do that. But in collaboration with Clint and Bridget and a very talented graduate student named Pickway. Oh, very good, very good. We were able to look at it by EM. And so this is negatively stained Dicer, and Complex was a little partner of it. Partner it has. And basically, the nice thing is you can see it has this little L shape here. And so what Pickway was able to do is he went through and he determined a very nice 3D reconstruction in stain at about 20 angstrom resolution. And right away, you can see it has this lovely L shape, and then you can start to see it stands 150 angstroms tall, and you can anthropomorphize it and say that it has a head and a back and a foot and an arm, and you can even roll it around, and you see all these features on it, and this is when it gets really frustrating, because you see things like this groove here, and you start to imagine that RNA will bind here, and there's things, this hook thing in the end, and there's this top, but you don't know what any of this stuff means. It just have this lovely shape. And so really that was the hardest part of the whole project, because we know what it looks like overall, and we know what all the parts and pieces look what we'll look like inside, but we just don't know how to fit them in. And really, until we could make this connection, we really could not. We could make a lot of guesses, but it was always just they're always just guesses. We couldn't really get functional insight into the mechanism of the enzyme until we could make this connection here. And so, just I mean, the problem. So we tried many, many things, and pretty much all of them failed. And it was a very long haul. But the problem really comes back. We want to know. I was asking Pickwait to basically tell me this little part here, the PAS domain binds the end of the RNA. Where is that in here? But I was struck by that huge thing is really just this little thing. So it's a very, very hard problem, actually. So like I said, we tried many things, and most of them most failed. But one thing worked quite nicely, and that was after reading a paper from Alice Ting's lab. Alice Ting is a professor at MIT, and she's working on strategies for labeling and visualizing molecules in cells, among other things. And what she developed was a monovalent form of streptavidin. And the way she was using it was she was employing this tag called an AVI tag. So an AVI tag is I think it's 14 amino acid sequence that is recognized by the enzyme biotin ligase. It's the E. coli enzyme. And so basically biotin ligase will recognize the sequence and attach a biotin to this lysine. And that then will give you a biotinylated form of your protein. And then the trick is you can then attach streptavidin to the biotin, which has a very, very high affinity. The trick that Alice Ting came up with was dealing with the problem that streptavidin is normally a tetramer. And so you'd have basically four binding sites. So she came up with a way, her lab came up with a way of developing these monovalent streptavidin, where only one of the subunit in the tetramer is competent for binding biotin. And so what we noticed was that sometimes they put the AVI tags on the N-terminus and sometimes they put them on the C-terminus. So that suggested it didn't really matter where you put it. And so we asked the question, can you put an AVI tag in the middle of your protein and then attach the streptavidin? And the answer is yes. So basically what we tried to do is make something that looked like this. So we know what the PAS domain, for example, looks like. This is the crystal structure of the actual thing we're trying to study. So basically what we did was insert the AVI tag sequence into a surface loop in the PAS domain, then biotinylate the protein and attach the streptavidin and see if we could see where the streptavidin is attaching. It's a nice 50 kilodalton sphere, basically. All right. Oh, so this is just this is a basic schematic of how it worked. So we start with the partially purified protein, found that worked the best, of the protein where it had the AVI tag inserted into, in this case, the PAS domain. And then we'd biotinylate it in vitro just using recombinant biotin ligase. The efficiency we got was about 50%. So about half the molecules would be labeled, the other half it didn't. I don't know why. Probably could have gotten it better if we needed to. But we didn't really need to because the next thing you can do is you just add in the monovalent streptavidin. And then, of course, the ones that are biotinylated have the streptavidin attached. And the way we set it up was that the streptavidin had a His tag while our protein did not at this point. So then we can purify away all of the unlabeled, untagged dicers just by binding to a nickel resin, by a nickel chelate. And that then gives you all of the dicers that were labeled plus all of the free streptavidin. But dicers so much bigger than, especially dicer plus streptavidin is much, much bigger than free streptavidin. So you can just do a size selection through size exclusion chromatography. And in principle, you end up with exactly this and only this. And then you're labeled dicer with the streptavidin tag. And so that is what we did. And this was a wonderful day because it was the first time something worked. These are little dicer Ls, and you can see for the first time now we had this extra little density coming off of the head in these class averages. So then Pickwin went back, and he basically just did RCT reconstructions from many of these. And then what I'm trying to show here is the labeled structure, which is colored, overlay on top of the unlabeled structure, which is shown as sort of a mesh. And what you can see is in every case, you have this extra streptavidin density sticking out. I don't have the streptavidin shown here, streptavidin crystal structure shown here, but it fits perfectly inside these little things. You can also see that there is some flexibility in where the streptavidin sits relative to the dicer. And so we weren't sure how to deal with this at first. We decided that the fairest way to deal with it would be just to try and estimate where these two proteins are attaching and then put, in this case, a purple sphere here. And then go through, find our best RT the best reconstructions and the one you have the most confidence in, and then align them, and then just see where many, many spheres fall. And you can see in this case, all of the spheres fell in the front of Dicer's head. And so that then told us that, okay, finally we know something, and that is then where the PAS domain resides, somewhere around here. And then this then is where the end of double-stranded RNA is recognized. So finally, after many long nights, we had some information about what the function of the structure. So once that works, then you just want to keep going. Then you start burning through it. So we the next thing you do is we label the platform domain, which is this sort of domain that sits next to the PAS domain with streptavidin, using another loop. Go through it, do it again, and this is really nice because it actually works pretty well. When it works, it works. When it works well. And so here's the L's, and now you have these little dots coming off of the back. Coming off the back of the head, you can do the reconstructions, and you can have all of these densities coming off of the back, and it looks very nice. And what was nice was now, before we had labeling in the front of the head, now we clearly have distinguishing label in the back. So we're now starting to have spatial resolution between these, about where these domains sit in this relatively small particle. And what was nice here, of course, is so we take the structure here, and these are basically where the sort of weighted average of where the sites fell for the PAS domain and the platform domain. And of course, we have the crystal structure of this PAS platform module, and we know which loops were labeled in here because we chose those loops. So we can start to use that information to start docking the crystal structure in. So basically, we know these loops were biotinylated. We know where the biotinylation sites were about. So we just use that information to dock it in. And once you do that, the fit actually was amazingly satisfying. It actually fit quite nicely up here in the top of the head. So it was very, very nice. So then, as I said, we just keep going. Next thing we want to know was so this is a part that recognizes the end of the RNA. Over here, the RNase-3 domains are involved in cleavage. So we knew there's a crystal structure of the RNase-3B domain. And in this domain, there was one really big disordered loop. It was about 30 amino acids, just completely disordered in the crystal structure. So we thought that would be a very nice target for adding the AVI tag, because this disordered loop is probably not contributing to the structure at all. It's probably out there flexible. So we did the same trick again. We added the AVI tag to this to a large loop in the RNase-3B domain. And then attached our streptavidin again, and we did that. We see it worked, but it wasn't actually as good this time. So here's the class averages. You can see these little densities coming off. But a problem was we started to see this extra density sort of floating. It's harder to say where it's coming from. But we try and be true to ourselves and just say, okay, well, we try and estimate where, forgetting, looking at each reconstruction independently, where would you say it's attaching? And you can just put a sphere there, and then you can go and see where all the spheres fall, and you can say, okay, well, so probably the RNase-3B domain is somewhere in this region here. And so then Pickway had the idea, so maybe we should try shortening the loop. If it's really disordered and it's not contributing anything to the structure, we cut it out. And so this was a 45 amino acid loop. Once we'd added the AVI tag into it. And so we just cut out a bunch of the loop indiscriminately down to 25 residues. And now all of a sudden all the little extra blobs start appearing more in the body of the, and then we feel much, much better about clustering somewhere around here. And so clearly we saw a nice correlation between the length of the loop and the amount of heterogeneity in the reconstruction. I also think it's harder to deal with the middle. The loops that were up here on the tops and the bottom, they were only 5 amino acid loops. They're very small, relatively, and they're sort of on this open territory here, which I think made it easier. When you're trying to deal with the middle, the body, I think it might just be harder. Maybe just for the alignment. I don't know. We always struggled with the middle part, but we basically nailed it down. And once we did that, then pretty good at just turning the crank and making many constructs. And basically, we just went through and labeled different sites of interest, and we were able to identify all of the sites, enough sites so we could pretty much dock in every crystal structure that we could imagine. I mean, that we had in our hands.
truth.
Yeah, I know. It's all a little bit dodgy, but it's okay. No, it's good. So this is the final model. So now this is the most important part in some ways, because now we have this model where everything fits in quite nicely. And the problem is there's lots of ways to make it fit, but this fits with all the labeling data as well. And you can actually start to draw a lot of mechanistic insight into the enzyme on this global scale. So for example, we know the PAS domain here binds to the end of double-stranded RNA. That's nice and good. The RNA's three domains we know are somewhere here in the body, and that's where the cleavage happens. But what's really nice is you can see these two things are separated from each other by a distance of roughly 60 angstroms, which would correspond to 21 base pairs, or two turns of an RNA duplex. And so we think this is how it basically finds the end and then cuts this set distance away, and that's what gives you the defined product of the defined size. And then over here, we have the helicase domains. And you can see, basically, if you dock a double-stranded RNA onto this, we know how RNA interacts with this domain and with this domain and with this domain. So it actually fits quite nicely. And you can rotate it around. And you can see the helicase domains form this clamp on the end. This is really nice. It's a RIG-I helicase that came out. It was published just as we were doing this work. And it was a very homologous domain. So it's really nice. So this helicase is not the kind of helicase that unwinds RNA, but it's the kind of helicase that translocates on RNA. And so this then gives us a model for thinking about how translocation happens, because we have basically, you can propose these steps where we have dicer binds to long double-stranded RNA, the PAS domain finds the end, you cleave it, that gives you your little product of this size, then the RNA comes off. But now the helicase domains stay associated with the long RNA, and then they can presumably use ATP energy to push the RNA in or translocate dicer along, bring you back to here. And so all of these things come together to now give you a much more robust working model for how this enzyme works. And that's basically it. So I should acknowledge, so Pickway is the graduate student that he did all the work and many, many other things to make this work. It was a very, very challenging project. And the kid was always smiling. I don't know how he always stayed so happy because there were some really dark days. But then there was Keelan, who undergraduate, who made many, many constructs. That might have been what kept Pickway happy. Is always someone feeding him.
You know, he may be smiling, but he looks a little.
Yeah, I know. Afraid. I know. Yeah, he's beaten down, but he's still okay. You can see. And then Bridget and Clint for tolerating the several years of failed attempts, and sticking with it, and thanks again for the talk, the chance to talk.
Just me. Is there some way you could put RNA and trap the thing into showing you the states of RNA on this?
Well, we certainly tried structure. To do that. We've tried to do that. Was some of our original strategies. We had labeled RNAs, and we've tried that. And I'd love to keep going. We haven't gotten to work yet. So maybe we're ready for another round. But I'd love to try. I'd love to see that, how it binds the RNA and what happens upon binding.
So two questions. First is, does your model give you some sort of killer mutations that you can make that will support it?
That's a good question. We haven't really tested it yet. We should.
It's a good thing you hadn't. You might not be giving the talk. The second question is, have others utilized this with other proteins? I mean, using the loop insertion and then the enzymatic attachments?
I've been contacted by a few labs that want to. I haven't heard any successes yet, but it's still pretty new. So hopefully, because that'd be nice.
So is there an advantage of using streptavidin over, say, like a Fab, linear Fab domain?
There could be. Well, so the nice thing about streptavidin is, I think the affinity is higher than a Fab. I mean, and it's cheap to make, and what else? It's very easily recognizable, and it seems to be very generic. You can just put it in. I guess if you had some epitope that your Fab recognized, you could do it that way. But it is a lot cheaper. It's really nice in that way.
So I'd actually like to make a sales pitch for using egg white Avidin instead of streptavidin, because if you have a huge excess of the egg white Avidin, it doesn't matter that it's not monovalent. And the other nice thing about egg white Avidin is it's glycosylated. So another cool trick that you can use is that unless you boil the sample, anything that's labeled with the Avidin doesn't actually enter the resolving gel. So you can estimate the efficiency of labeling very quickly.
Oh, that's very nice.
So do you think there's an advantage over this strategy versus, David brought it up, GFP insertions at various places, or using any protein that have its N and C termini rather close together that would be, you know, a stable domain that you could insert easily? Then you get 100% labeling efficiency.
Yeah, it's true. So I think if you're only doing termini, I think putting GFP or something works pretty well. We did the C-terminus too, and it was actually really flexible. But we tried doing GFP and things like that, and the success rate was a lot lower. So we probably made 12 constructs with the AviTag insertion, and 10 of them were fine biochemically. So the success rates, for at least in our hands, were a lot higher because the insertion was so much smaller, and the big label is being added post-translationally. So I think just folding, in terms of just preparing the sample, our success rate was much higher. So the GFP constructs, we'd get these weird aggregates that were green, but they were aggregated and they were kind of a mess. Well, the streptavidin worked.
Maybe some other protein that has terminus very close to one another.
Yeah. Yeah.
There could be other things that would be, very stable domains that would fold very rapidly, and so would only help the folding process.
Yeah, I think it could. I mean, people do these kind of things. Yeah, I think they're probably also good.
Ian, you probably mentioned it, but what was Dohler's?
Oh, that was
PRS.
Pickway had this idea that if you make something an acronym, then you'll become famous. I think it was. Well, the whole problem was trying to figure out what these domains were. So we called it domain DO localization, by RCT sampling. RCT sampling is me just making it lots of structures to make sure we have it in the right place. But yeah, domain. That's what it is.
It was pain.
Yeah, it was.
Any other questions? Thanks again, Ian. Great talk.